History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are untold stories there that need to be told and that definitely need to be heard. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today we get to meet 95-year-old Joe Reyes of Fresno, California, who served with the 473rd Anti-Aircraft Artillery in Europe during World War II. But why don't we start out with your childhood, Joe?
Well, I grew up in Monterey Seaside. I remember my dad and I used to go out clam hunting when the tide was out. We went back and forth, and he knew when the tide would be out, and he would clams, and he'd get a rock clam, and he'd dip it in clear water. Of course, he'd take the clam out of the shell, and he would have lemon and salt. He couldn't see how he could down that. It's worse than a raw egg. So it wasn't long he had me eating them, too. And that went on for a while, and then on one day, he decided to go to Mexico. He made the truck like a covered wagon. He said, "We're going to Mexico." Well, it's no big deal to me. I was a young boy. He got the truck loaded with the supplies that we're going to need. We went to Mexico. Our aim was to get to Sonora. We faced rain, wind. And then one time we faced Apaches. They go out in front of the truck over there, and Dad didn't take out the Winchester he had on the truck. He was wise. So he got out and he talked to them. You can see the big feathers on them, you know. And I looked at him. To me, that was wonderful to see Indians like that. But to him, they knew what he had to do. So he went back to the truck and he got a sack full of corn, brought it out, gave it to the Indians. They were satisfied. They took off. Well, after that, we faced thunder and rain, lightning. We got to a doggone place that was swaying from the torrent of the river, you know. In those days, they didn't make bridges like they do today, you know. You could see the bridge moving a little bit. He says, "We got to go across now, or if we wait, this level will wash the bridge out." As we went on, you could see the truck swaying from one side to the other a little bit. I was scared. He didn't show no fear. Well, we made it across. As soon as we got to Sonora, we headed to a town named Ciudad Obregón. And that's where we began our stay in Sonora for 5 years. I attended school, and I learned Spanish real good. The only time we spoke English was at home. My mother and father did not allow us to speak English out in the crowd or anything. We were afraid they might think that we're talking about them. And some of those people despised that. We went to school. We stayed there for about 5 years before we lose our citizenship. My father and my mother had a disagreement one day, so she decided to leave him and come back. He brought us back on the truck, clear to a place that my Aunt Marion had acquired for us to stay. He unloaded the truck for whatever things we had very little, and he went back. From there, we just stayed with my aunt. Pretty soon my mother got a job, and we moved to Sunset Bunker Hill, about 2 miles from Hollywood. And then I acquired a dishwashing job there. Attended school, which I was enrolled in the fifth grade. From there, we moved to Rosemead. And then my mother had a job managing a nursery. She had a green thumb, so she managed the nursery for about 6 months. Things get pretty bad, you know, in those days. So from there, we decided to move from Rosemead. That's when I enlisted in the service.
Well, let me ask you about those early years. So you're born in America. English is your first language. You go into Mexico, and your parents say, don't speak any English. They're going to discriminate against you for speaking English, right?
That's right, yes. And if we went to a restaurant, we didn't speak no English because for the same reason. Some people are, you know, they just don't like, they call it repatriados. You know what that means? We're deported. That's what they thought we were because they could tell that we were not original Mexicans.
Well, it just hit me that here you're in Mexico and you have to be concerned about being discriminated against because you're American. But then also here in America, you face discrimination for being Mexican-American.
I did that while I was in the service when I had different jobs. The only place I didn't receive discrimination was when this World War II veteran hired me to do welding jobs in his shop. It was over there in Frisco. And then another time that I never faced discrimination was when I was a heavy-duty mechanic. From there on, no one discriminated. We're all in the same boat. We're heavy-duty mechanics, truck mechanics. Bumper to bumper. I did well. I learned that my apprenticeship and everything and became a journeyman and I got top wages. I remember Fresno Truck Center. Everybody worked together. I didn't feel no discrimination at all there. And I was satisfied with the job. I did good work. I finally retired from there. By that time, the wife was always saving the nickels and dimes, you know, and we decided to travel. See America. I wanted to see America because I fought for my country and I almost died several times. Came close to dying twice, three times, but man, it was close enough to turn you white. All of us in the center half track. One of them boys one time says, Joe, you look better brown than white. That was Andrew J. Scopetti. I'll never forget his name because we were real close. Uh-huh. He was Italian from Brooklyn, and we became best friends.
Let me go back with you a little bit. So I'm just wondering, when you were that boy, you and your brothers are growing up in Mexico. If you go back to that time, here you are a boy with your whole life in front of you. Did you have some ideas, hey, when I grow up, I'm going to do this or that? Did you have some of those ambitions or dreams?
I knew what my responsibility. As I grew up, I didn't think about marriage then. It was only when I was discharged from the service when I saw this girl, you know, and golly, that's the only girl I made my heart jump out of my chest. That's the one I want, you know. 3 months later, we married, you know. And my ambition was to become a pattern maker because I had the makings of a pattern maker, to make a pattern maker because it was a nice, clean job and it paid good. Well, it didn't turn out that way. The boss at the Fresno Brass introduced me to another brass company. I can't remember the name of it. And they didn't hire me. And I had the experience behind me. They didn't hire me. And I could see the look and the face of that fella. Only I can experience that. And I can read in his eyes what he's thinking. Well, he's brown, he's Mexican. So I didn't get the job. This is rolling over to us from these Mexicans that are killing themselves left and right, which I despise. Their actions is rolling onto us that we're trying to make a good life for ourselves. So that brings a bad name to the good Mexican. They're trying to make a good future. So that's in many ways that stops us because they think they, whoever looks at us, they think that we're about the same. But I shrugged all of that off and kept on going with my life. As I said, I became a heavy-duty mechanic.
And long before that, you had to learn hard work. When you were 15, you went to the Civilian Conservation Corps?
It was advertised in the paper that if you wanted to learn about trees, you know, different kinds of trees, trails, streams, how to make cattle guards, how to fight fires, which we did fight fires, and we came pretty close to be trapped in a pocket of fire. The foreman knew what was coming, and he says, "Let's get out of here right now." You know, and then we hightail it, and you can see the fire coming over the top of the trees. You won't believe this. We was running, and it was a canal. We're running over the bridge. You look to the right like that. There was all kinds of animals and the dog on water rushing, getting away from the fire. Nobody was fighting nobody. Everybody, all the animals were on the same boat. They were running from the fire. You'll never forget that sight.
You mean like bears and deer and raccoons and anything that lives in the forest is all running the same way?
All of them were in the same canal. And you could tell they were all scared because of the fire. So we escaped that and they sent it some other direction to fight, make fire trails, you know, and all that stuff. And there was about 50 to 20 of us. I say about 20. And we make fire trails all day long. We get in about 11 o'clock at night. 5 o'clock, we had to get up and take off again until the fire was controlled by the fire department. Not many acres burned then. They really got the fires under control fast. So we were glad that it was over with because there was hard work all day long, you know, out there. We make fire trails. We had a mop-up. You know what a mop-up is? You get a strap of a 10-gallon can on your back with a syringe. Well, we're all lined up, and you walk, and you see it smothering, and you get the syringe to put it out. All day long, you go with that syringe. You got to go into a stream and you fill up again. Not only me, and be about 20 of them strung out. The foreman knew what he was doing. There, after everything and the fire was over and everything was under control, we had just go back to camp and go to our duties of maybe knocking down dead trees, planting new trees after a fire. We would plant trees all day long. We had like a sack. And you knew how to pull out each little tree. And you hit the ground with a mattock, pull back, drop the tree, let the soil go back to cover the tree. That was all day long. You're through with one sack full, you got another one. And we were strung out. Anyone that travels above Norfolk can see the trees lined. Because those are the trees we planted.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. So you planted these almost 80 years ago. And so those trees have grown a little bit. How many times have you gone back up there to see the trees you planted?
I never did go back over there. You know, once I got so busy with my life, you know, working, and so I never went back up there. I should have really to see our work. But a beautiful trees by now.
So teenagers today, they have a hard time understanding what this was. But here you're 15 years old, and you're going, and you're working hard. It's almost like being in the military, but then the money that you were earning would go back to your family?
Because we had everything there. Laundry, food, quarters, barracks to sleep in. So that Camp Tuolumne, they called it, up above Norfolk. There was very little money then, but I learned a lot. I learned about trees. I learned about, animals, from rattlesnakes on up. It was really gratifying. To me, it was very good experience that I had.
You would get to keep $5, and then 25 went to your family back home?
Yes, at that time, yes, yeah. To help Mom. Yeah. That was a lot of money in those days, you know, $25.
It kind of sounds like that made you grow up a little bit.
My experience made me sometimes a little more hardened when I clenched my fists and I wanted to whack somebody that made a remark about my race, you know. But I said, "And I got nothing to gain. He's not hurting me anyhow." So I let that go.
Well, not long after that, something happened that changed the world. December 7th, 1941, the attack on Pearl Harbor. Do you remember where you were and how you found out?
Pearl Harbor. You know, sometimes I wish I was there. I was a gunner. I can just imagine it was horror for the Americans that they got bombed from the Japanese. To me, the Japanese were not the soldiers. They were barbarians. That's why they lost the war. They gotta be humanly when you fight also a war, you know.
And your brother fought against him over there. You would end up in Europe. I'm curious, though. I've talked to a lot of people who were in the Los Angeles area at that time. And it sounded like life in L.A. changed a little bit after Pearl Harbor, as far as curfews and concern that the Japanese may even try to bomb L.A. Do you remember that?
Oh, yes. They were making Venetian blinds, black on one side, white on the other. At night, you would turn the Venetian blind to black because we were afraid the Japanese were going to attack, you know. So that went all over the country. Venetian blinds were selling like hotcakes.
I know we're bouncing around here, but did you play any sports or anything like that in high school?
I played baseball, football. I wanted to play football, but then I weighed 140 pounds. I went to a McKinley High School, all black. But you know what? Never did they bother me. We played football, and they run over me. I'm telling you, I get up next morning, I was all sore. I thought I had broken bones, but I was just sore, you know. They were tough. So I said, "My, this sport is no good for me. I can't even get up to go play again." So I stuck to baseball. There I became an outfielder. I loved that. I played as long as I could till I graduated. But I already had the experience of welding under my belt because I get out of school and go to a welding class. And I became a certified welder, a mechanical welder, and I used that because every shop I went to, welding was required. I came right out of high school, and no time at all, I got a job in a defense plant as a welder. $1.10 an hour, top wages. Not a lot of money in those days, you know, a dollar. It's equivalent to 30 now. My mom had that nursery across the tracks. It was Glendale. One day I come home, and she said, "Look, son," she brought out the papers, a big write-up, you know, about the army and all the privileges if you enlist. Son, he says, "You know, it'd be better if you enlist because they are offering him whatever you want in the army. That's what you'll have. You get your choice. If you are drafted, you have no choice. They put you where they want." So I was kind of skeptical about that, you know. So I finally said, "Okay, I'll enlist. They're going to draft me anyhow."
Well, would you have had a deferment because of your defense plant job?
No, I didn't think about a deferment at all. But to my experience, here's what happens. I was going up on the beach in Omaha with the half tracks. The infantry was right there coming off the landing barges. And there was this fellow walking along in the infantry beside my half track. He looks up at me, "Hey, Joe, what are you doing up there?" "Yeah, what do you think, man? I enlisted, you got drafted in your own foot." "Yeah," I said, "man, I should have listened to you." You know, that's what he said. Well, I didn't think about a deferment at all. To my knowledge, he told me the plant closed up after 3 months because they had the supply of those square tanks that we used to weld. I'm getting ahead of myself. We come off the landing bridges, and I look down as the half track moved in a little bit this way, and I look down. Those big tanks that we made were full of air, and they supported our half tracks, tanks, and infantry, you know. That's what they would use them for, floating pontoons.
So what you were welding were big tanks that they would fill with air so they could have pontoon barges?
They were on the water, you know, full of air. They supported. It's the only thing I think of because otherwise, why would they have them down there? And they moved a little. It's a heavy. Tanks went over them, you know. They even move a light half tracks, and you think you're going to flip over. But they supported our troops, tanks, and all.
So it's possible that your half track drove ashore over those pontoons that you had actually welded.
Yes, because they had to use the pontoons because the barges were heavy with equipment and they can only go so far. They're way down on the water and before they hit the beach. So they had to have pontoons to float so that barges that were carrying the equipment, trucks and everything, were able to get off. That's what they were for.
It's time for our first break, but when we come back, we'll hear some of what Joe Reyes experienced over the year that followed, including some of his closest calls in Europe. Find photos and video of Joe at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's conversation with 95-year-old Joe Reyes of Fresno, California, one of three brothers to serve in our armed forces. After arriving at Normandy's Omaha Beach about a week after the initial landings, he served in an M-15 half-track crew. Truck wheels in the front, tank tracks in the back, plenty of firepower aboard. And how many men in that half-track crew, Joe?
Well, there's seven altogether. One to operate 37 millimeter, two to operate the 50 calibers, vertical tracker, and horizontal tracker, and I was a gunner. When I saw that we were probably getting a hit, why then I let loose with the 37 millimeter. The 50 calibers are being fired by the cannoneers. They're feeding the 50 calibers machine gun. The other one is making sure feeding the 37 millimeter. It's automatic. You don't have to load. You just got a cartridge of 10, and we just go the right down as you're firing automatic with a 37 millimeter gun. There was the sergeant in the driving compartment of the half track, and there's the driver, and there's five of us inside of the half track hopper to operate them, the machine guns and the 37 millimeter gun.
You mentioned Omaha Beach, so this is less than a week after the initial landing. You're D-Day plus six, early June 1944. Can you help us understand what you saw when you came ashore? What that whole scene looked like, sounded like, smelled like?
Oh, yeah. You know, the Corps has to pick up all the dead bodies, and according to their tags, they're identified. We saw bodies still floating. It was something that you just can't bring it into mind. It's you can't say it's horrible. It's worse than that. The boys that survived that invasion, I don't think they'll ever be the same again. Their eyes, what they saw, what they felt, it's you can't explain what your eyes saw. It's to hell and back. That's what it is. It's the only way you can describe it. You know, to hell and back. I don't know if I can answer anymore.
Well, so you're seeing all this evidence of what's happened in the preceding days, and none of that's very encouraging. But then you're going to be fired upon as well. What was the first instance of that you experienced? What was the first hazard or danger to yourself that you realized?
Shoot them before they shoot me. Survive. You keep your wits and operate your guns properly, and don't be afraid. If you're afraid, don't show it. Just hide it and do your job, or else you're not going to be around. They're going to kill your position. So you don't even think about that. You're operating that gun and boom, 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 bang. And so not only my half-track, but the other half-tracks get them before they get me. That was a motto we had to do. We didn't even, when you're operating that gun, you don't think about dying. You only think about making accurate to make sure you knock down the planes. That was our motto.
Well, that's what I was going to get to. So you're the 473rd Anti-Aircraft Artillery Battalion. So your job is to shoot down planes. What was the first opportunity you had to do that? What was the first time you encountered enemy planes?
Well, we encountered them when our supplies were coming on board. We were positioned inland already. We had columns of material providing the war, guns, tanks, quartermaster. You know, they carry the food and all of that. And we'd be right there on besides the side of the road, all strung out. The whole battalion strung out like that, give them air cover. Sometimes we got them, and sometimes some of them was bound to sneak in, and the bay battery would get the most of it because they were way up ahead. But we made sure we stay alive by being accurate. If the planes were too far, we would shoot a barrage. And they never make it. The tens of that barrage was like 4th of July. They knew they couldn't get to that barrage, so they come down low, right beside your gun position. You couldn't fire. You know, and then way over there, they come up.
And so these would be Messerschmitt 109s or the FW 190s who are diving and strafing you guys?
Messerschmitts and the Stuka and the Wolf. They had a bomber, and then they didn't try to bomb us. They just go right down, and you can shoot at them. Our barrage was so intense. I mean, to tell you, they get hit before they even get to the target. We instead of using my scope for the distance, just fire out there, try and get as close as you can to him because he's about 2 miles out and he's out of range on your mill screen. So you just fire above him and ahead of him. He's so far out, but still you can still get a hit. You get a still barrage, you're still effective.
So what you guys were doing, because of the strength of how many anti-aircraft guns you had, you were creating a wall of flak that they would have to fly through?
That's it. A wall of fire. And it was difficult for them to get through it. And they were getting hit. Like I said, they just died out. No. And you couldn't fire at them. They go by and they would wave. Especially the ones on the bombers. They turn around there. You could see their face and they wave like this. You know, give out the old salute. And we go like this.
You give him the one-finger salute?
One-finger story. Well, we give him five.
Well, you can laugh about it now. But at the time, as a teenager, halfway around the world with bullets flying.
We were serious. I'm going to tell you, we were serious because we knew what their mission was, to try and hit the column, you know, that was going up to the front supplies, supplying some of the troops that were up there on front. You know, tanks were going up there to the front. Germans were retreating. They had some standoff, you know, but where it cost us a little lives, but we kept on going, and we all thought the same thing. Let's get this over with so we can go home.
Well, and you said earlier that there were a few moments where you weren't sure you were going to come home, where your brown Mexican skin turned white because you were so afraid. Now, is that hyperbole, or you think you really turned white?
Well, there was one airplane we hit, and I'm telling you, that plane didn't change direction. He came straight at our half track. And I say, hey, that guy is hit. why is he coming straight? And then the first thought we said, he's committing suicide. Cover. And all we did was just cover like that because we didn't have time to jump into the slit wrenches. So we just cover like this, and whoosh, he went right by. He missed us by 5 feet. 5 feet, one where you could smell the, you know, the air as it went by. He still had his bomb in there. He went by us and hit a building about 40 yards away. We could feel the concussion of the bomb, made a big hole over there. And then everybody on the battery was phoning on D battery, in our section. And some of the other sections, everybody was phoning to see if we were all right. They actually thought we got hit. You know, it came so close. And another time, still in supply lines. And we stopped for about, 5 minutes. Sometimes they stop. You got to follow the lead jeep. With the colonel or the major, and I felt the pain when... we stopped and we unlock our cannon. You lock it, keep it from going like this, you know, because there's so much play on the turret. Mm-hmm. So you lock it. First thing we did was unlock the gun. We turn it around so we had maybe a feel of fire there in case we were told to fire at will. All of a sudden, there was a ping! Cling, 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 and the doggone bullet came around inside of the half track, you know. While a sniper, the reason that bullet was going that way, because it hit the barrel of the gun on the very edge of the barrel, and I was right behind it. He missed me, and because he hit the barrel of the gun with maybe that much.
So you were less than an inch away from getting hit by that sniper's bullet.
And then I heard an infantryman say, "We'll get him." You know, the infantry coming up. It was already dusk. And he said, "We'll get him." I heard him say that.
So you're sitting in the half track behind the barrel of that gun. They shoot right at the barrel. It glances off the side and ricochets all throughout your half track, but never hits you.
I never did find that. I wanted to find that ricocheting bullet and never did find it. You know, I would have taken it as a memoir, you know. Well, my heart went boom, 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 man, you know. And, he missed me. It was a good thing. He would have hit me right here.
Right in the heart?
Yes, right above the heart. It would have hit me. I still think the barrel of that gun was in the way that it ricocheted off.
So you land in Normandy. In June of 44, you go through the Normandy campaign. Where did you go from there?
We went to Belgium. We got to Belgium. We headed toward the front. That was up with the troops, you know. Sometimes you'll get right in there. We went up. It was a cold, cold, cold. You couldn't do zero. Infantry was going up. You could see it strung out one side to the other. Bazooka guys, you know, but the equipment. Well, you couldn't travel through the snow. It was about, must have been about 8 feet high. So they could walk through the snow. And one of them said, "See those two guys over there? See, they're frozen. Two Germans were frozen." He says, "They were covered with a blanket." We took the blanket off, and there it is. Two Germans frozen to death. We ask each other, "What are we doing here with all these trees? And what are we going to use us as artillery?" "Can't even use us as artillery. We're not up in the front. We're way behind, and the trees are like Yosemite, you know. I mean, there was no place for us." Sure enough, about half or an hour later, there comes a jeep going right through beside the half tracks. And he stops at the leading column, you know, and turned us around, got out of there. They had no use for us. Airplanes, the weather, the way it was, neither side could fly because, you know, they wouldn't know where the bombs were going to land. We didn't have the equipment then that we have now, you know. All we had was radios. And...
So you're talking about the Battle of the Bulge. The weather was so bad, the visibility was so low that flying wasn't feasible until right around Christmas when that finally broke. At that time, did they move you guys back into position or no?
Yes, we went to Holland. We was lined our battery up, covering Patton's tanks going into Germany from Holland. Well, the Holland people were really grateful for the liberation. Some of us said, if the Germans break through here, they'll send you back to the sea, just like that Dunkirk from the British. And we were afraid of that. And if they come back and they know that we were friendly with the troops, he says, we don't know what's going to happen to us. So it didn't happen. They were very grateful. It was a nice, beautiful place, Holland. Better than, I think it was better than even Paris. We loved that place. The people, well, are speaking English. A lot of them, most of them spoke English. Teachers were out there, professors and everything. And up ahead, you could hear the doggone firing, you know, of the infantry. And they didn't care. We were being liberated. They came out there, the bullets were bouncing everywhere, and they didn't care. Welcome the Americans, you know. So we covered Patton. It wasn't long. A week, then we went into Germany. We were about 15 miles on the superhighway. Autobahn, they called it. They stopped us. Germans had given up. British from the left over there, the Russians from over there, and a stream of people coming back from Germany to the American side. They didn't want nothing to do with the Russians. They didn't know what to expect from the Russians because of the war that Germany had caused Russia at that time. So maybe they were out for revenge and they didn't want nothing to do with them. So there's a stream of refugees coming to the American sectors. Well, war was over. They brought us home. We wanted to see Berlin, actually. We waited. We were then sent back to England on barges. We waited in England for about 3 months because we didn't have enough points. The infantry had most of the points. You know, the GIs had been on foot and tanks. And the front fighting, they earned more points, so they get to go home first. And we were just on the aircraft, so we waited about 3 months. We played baseball, football, lifted weights, everything, you know, to pass the time. Finally, they sent us home.
But that journey home would not be quite as smooth as he expected, not on the water and not on land once he got home to California. I'm not sure you've heard a story quite like his homecoming story before. We'll circle back to his time in Europe, too. And wait until you hear 95-year-old Joe Reyes sing. I guarantee you've never heard this song before. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 95-year-old Joe Reyes of Fresno, California, Army veteran from the 473rd AAA, anti-aircraft artillery during World War II. We're going to get a couple other memories from his time in Europe, but when we left off, he was talking about coming home from the war, something obviously you were looking forward to, Joe, but that didn't exactly go according to plan. I think our audience is going to get a kick out of this story, so tell us, how'd you get home?
In a victory ship. We didn't like that. 500 troops in a victory ship is light, you know, it's small. Hit a storm out there coming home, and we thought we'd drown. That thing was out there, like, up like that. You lost the sea. Come down, and the sea was up there. We thought we had it. I mean, to tell you, it was rough. Finally, we hit calm seas, you know. And those calm seas were still rough, but we made it to New York.
So you must have sailed past the Statue of Liberty then.
Oh, yes, there's the old lady, we said. You know, we're sure glad to see her, the old lady. And they put us in barracks, in our hot, nice, warm barracks there, waiting for us to board a plane to come here to California, the ones that were from California. So we landed in Camp Bill, and that's where they brought us. Greyhounds will take you, get the one going to Fresno, the ones that are going to Fresno. Okay, we'll go out there. And there's a line, we'll never get that. We'll probably wait till morning to board a Greyhound. So one of the guys said, let's get out there and hitchhike. We'll go out there on the highway, and the doggone car pulls up. You guys looking for a ride? Yeah. We pile it in on top of other guys, and then in that car going the same direction, you know. So we finally got into Fresno, and the guy said, you guys get into the Greyhound and phone a taxi. They'll take you home. And that's what I did.
Do you remember the look on your mother's face when you walked through the door?
Oh, let me tell you. I went to the address they gave me, and that was my aunt's house. So I knocked on the door. It was late at night. My uncle and my aunt come out. I didn't know them. So I embraced my aunt thinking it was my mother. Because, you know, she looked like so much like her mother. I'm home, Mom. Well, son, I'm not your mom, but thanks for the hug. You know, she's that type of woman, you know.
Uh-huh.
I'll take it to her, Mom. You can hug her all you want. She said. So from there, we got home and got a big party for my homecoming. Everybody was glad that I made it home. My brothers came from the service, and they were discharged, too. Well, my life went on from there on. I didn't waste no time in trying to get a job.
And we heard a little bit of that, but I want to circle back to Europe, because Tom Pearson, who suggested I interview you, told me you had a story about a brush with a German Tiger tank.
Our infantry seemed to bypass this little town, but in the process, you know, advancing equipment of all kinds. They went around this town, but some of them got caught in that town by Germans. There were Germans in there. So they made prisoners of this. I think it was 100 of them. Well, we got set up to fire on chateaus where high buildings where there was Germans directing motor fire. So we set up, we didn't pay attention to the motor fire. We set up we put a mirror in the bridge of our guns, and then we look into the mirror, and there was crosshairs in the barrel from the mirrors we put in there. And they tell us you fire at that, when you're on target, fire on that chateau, 50 calibers too. Synchronize that one building. When you give the order to fire, everyone was different. Positions, different targets, and doing the same thing. So you give it a burst of 50s, and you see where they're going, see where the tracers are going. You might have to make some adjustments because we're about a mile away, I guess. But that's nothing for a 50s and a 37 millimeters. But the motor fire was coming in. The Germans knew that when we fired the 50 calibers, that we were going to fire again. Because we were on target now. So they get out of there. Because they knew what we was going to really pour the bullets there down there. And the cannon. They get out of there quick. If it was a church, we didn't destroy it. There might be some shrapnel on it, but that's about all. They got out of there so fast when they saw the second, third, fourth wave of infantry coming up with bazookas. You know, they got their field glasses. They could tell what's coming up. Right at that time, we pulled out of there. And then because the motor fire stopped, so we let the infantry do the next job. Here I came pulling out, and we looked back, and we were right there on the field of fire of this Tiger tank. And I tell the guys, we tell the driver, hey, put it in overdrive, there's a Tiger tank. And so he's got us. Look at him, he's got us. Because we see him pointing the barrel, you know. Oh my God, he's gonna really let it out. And all of a sudden, the lid of the tank opens up, and the German come up with their hands up. They must have seen all the bazookas, you know, everything. Well, when we pulled out of there, we were on our way to do other jobs because we were unattached. We might be with tanks one day, with a quartermaster car or airfield or something, you know, but we were unattached. But we never told where we were going. Well, as we pulled out of the town to go toward the front, there we see those GIs strung on back roads. Oh, man, it was a sight. To held them back. That's, we went up there and went right beside them. They were all strung out to hell and back. The whole column stopped right there. I don't know why, because the leading Jeep is way up ahead. We looked at those GIs and man alive, they held them back. Some were crying, some were sitting on their helmets, some up against trees, not saying a word. All of a sudden, a sergeant stands up. He struggles to come to our half track. He puts his hands up, and I thought he was going to shake my hand, but he put his hand on the side of the half track to steady himself. And he looked with those eyes. Oh, man, this is Joe. You know, they call Joe anybody. Hey, Joe, you have anything to eat? We haven't eaten in days. Tiger Fury, Grossgrutz, get those cans out of the turret of the hollow and throw them over the side. So we did that. I mean, we had a lot of spam. We didn't want like spam. So we had a lot of spam in the turret. That's a hollow place. Cans of everything. And we threw them over the side. Man, you ought to see those guys rush. They rushed to the doggone cans. They got their bayonet out. And they didn't use a church key. You know what a church key is?
Yeah.
They didn't use that. They could use their bayonets to open a nuclear with bare hands and just open the food like that.
Because these are the American soldiers who'd been captured that you guys just liberated by taking out that chateau?
Yes. Well, the Germans knew what was coming next. That's why they let them loose, and they gave up themselves as prisoners, too. That's when we pulled out of there. Yeah, that sight, we'll never forget, none of us. Our first impression was hell and back. All of those that I went with, buddies that were in the service, they're all gone. Those were the only friends I had at that time, you know. They're gone now. And I wish them or pray for them, you know, that they're better off than I am now.
How close did you guys become? Because you're going through things no one should have to go through.
There's only two guys I got close to. The rest, they despised me, not only because I was Mexican, but because I had the top position in the half track. I could tell them what to do in there. He said, Joe, you're not as smart as we are. How come you got that high position here? You're only a corporal. We got no stripes. Well, who's the smartest? You that you got drafted or I enlisted? You know, I still remember that. He said, Joe, don't bother with them. Don't clench your fist. They're just jealous. Scopetti. I'll never forget that name. Andrew J. Scopetti. The Italian from Brooklyn. In those days, oh, man, we had a grand time, Scopetti and I. Anybody else? The war is over, Joe. You go your way, I go mine. That's what the other guy said.
Were you aware of the concentration camps where all these Jews and other political prisoners were being held?
We saw the ovens. Yeah, we saw the ovens. I remember one time going up to the Harz Mountains, way up there, a village way up in the mountains. We passed those ovens, and you know, they were all strung out, you know, where they burned up the Jews and all that. They was isolated, so been liberated and everything already. We didn't see anything that our eyes could endure, you know. So we went up to the Harz Mountains. We set up positions over there, checking people coming in and out of the village, make sure that they lived there, make sure that somebody didn't sneak in some spies of any kind. We check them out. Yes, and we didn't stay there long.
I don't want to leave anything important out, So if there's anything else you think of, feel free to share. But I also don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us some of your experiences. I guess what I'm interested in knowing is, what's your perspective on what you guys did over there, why it should be still significant and remembered today?
First of all, our motto was, let's get this war over with so we can go home. So that made us fight a little harder. We wanted to get it over with and go home. And we did. It cost us lives. But those GIs that gave their lives so that we can enjoy the fruits of our work today, they'll never be forgotten. That's why we celebrate Veterans Day, Armistice Day, honoring those that were left behind. They made it possible for us to enjoy our liberty. It's in our hearts and minds. The whole country supports our GIs, and they pay honor to the fallen ones. That's why our country exists today. Liberty and justice for all. You can't get any more liberty than that.
What would you say you're most proud of?
Well, I'm proud of the people that are grateful. Today, they show their gratefulness of the sacrifice that was made to keep America free.
You know, I was just thinking, listening to your close calls that you talked about, the Messerschmitt that almost crashed into you, the sniper bullet that just missed you. I've heard a lot of different answers to this. Did you feel like someone was looking out for you?
Well, my mom said, I'll light those candles while you're gone, and I'll pray for you. The candles will never go out. They won't even go out after you come home, because we're going to be grateful that you come home. And I guess your prayers had a lot of effect. That's our Catholics believe in that. So mom was... To us, she was the greatest mother that ever lived.
And I've got to ask you, since you're 95, you're still in great shape, and your hair's not even really gray yet at age 95, what's your secret to staying so young and active?
Well, you know, the exercise, the secret of longevity. You must exercise. You must keep your heart alive all the time. Don't let him sit down in a rocking chair. Vegetables, very essential. Fruits are very essential. And as long as I can remember, I take a hot shower, and then I cool the water till it's cool on my head, and it rinse off with that cool water. That closes the pores on your the cool water. And you feel better than when you get out of the shower with just hot water. So it works for me. My mother taught us all that. To me, she was the greatest mother that ever lived.
Well, I just remembered the one other thing I have to have you do. You gonna sing for me?
There was a hiney who lived in Berlin, who thought it could rule all the world. He must have forgotten the stars and stripes and the land on the which we unfurl. In Texas, they trained us to knock out his planes. He'll know us by 473. The best of the jackals goes to anti-aircraft, especially to Battery D. Battery D, Battery D, our aim will be known well. We'll spot 'em and track 'em at midpoint, we'll smack 'em. We'll do our job well or we'll die. Bless 'em all, bless 'em all. The handwriting up on the wall. We just won't be mastered by those German bastards. We'll do our job well or we'll die. We'll do our job well or we'll die.
Who came up with that?
That was an Irishman in Mike's squad. His name was Tiger Fury. He's always writing poems. He could write letters to his mom, to anybody, with the highest penmanship and the manner in which he wrote the poem or a happy birthday. He was great at that. So one day he told me, Joe, you have a great voice and I want you to learn this song. I learned it, you know, by reading it over and over again. Then he sang it for me, and that's the way I sang it a little while ago.
So you've been singing that for 75 years?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. I don't forget it. It's right down to the point.
And if you'd like to see Joe Reyes singing that song and witness the animation in his expressions as he does, check out the video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.